So I will give Mr. Anas Al-Tikriti first the floor, and then we will listen from Ms. Lauren Booth, and then we will have our question and answer sessions. Thank you.
I have to say, this is very cool. I'm taking this home with me. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وأفضل الصلاة وأتم التسليم على الهادي الأمين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. In the name of our Lord Almighty, the most gracious, the most merciful, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, peace be upon you all. It's indeed a great pleasure and privilege to be here with you today. And I'd like to first of all start by thanking the organizers of this week event. I've had a very quick look at the exhibition outside, and I've had a very brief chat with some of you, and I take it that up until this particular moment, it's been a tremendous success. Hopefully the next half hour won't do anything to destroy that. Seriously, it's a real pleasure to see how Muslim academics, young academics, whole platforms where essentially people can come, discuss, agree, disagree, propose conflicting ideas and theories, and then go away with some more queries and questions in mind. You see, the thing is, we are totally obsessed about finding answers, when in reality, it's the questions that we should be searching for. Because most people who ultimately found a particular path that they became convinced was their path, their destiny, you ask them how they found that, and they will more than often say that it started off with a question. There was a question in my mind. There was something that was niggling. It was a niggling feeling, and something that just didn't go away until I came to where I am. So I congratulate the organizers of this event, and I hope that, inshallah, by the end of the week, you would have found that you would have achieved all the aims and objectives that you set out to achieve at the outset. Now, when talking about a subject as interesting, as exciting, as invigorating, and also as dangerous and as sensitive and controversial as the media, you often fail to pinpoint a point of departure. Where do you start? What is the opening line? Where do you depart from? Saying how important the media is? Do I need to say that? Is there anyone here who doubts the importance of the media today? If anyone did a few weeks ago, then I'm pretty sure that events in the Middle East over the course of the past six weeks have convinced us all of the immense power of the media. In fact, I was on a radio show recently when my co-guest said something very interesting. And he said, finally, the West has found its weapons of mass destruction. And that is the media. Because believe it or not, whether we like it or not, but the Americans, when they invaded Iraq in 2003, it took them nigh on 26 days, with using the most brutal, powerful weapons known to mankind, bombarding a country, bringing it to its knees. It took 26 days. Yet, for a country like Tunis, or for Egypt, or hopefully, inshallah, now for Libya, unarmed, defenseless civilians, taking to the streets, but using the tool of the media, they managed to bring a 30-year-old dictator, a 30-year-old dictatorship, and quite a brutal regime, very, very strong, very powerful, with an army, to its knees. No arms whatsoever. So there is no question that we all agree about the importance of the media and how significant it is in changing not only individuals' and societies' perceptions and understandings, but also of creating landslide changes and transformations in political terrains, in social terrains, in demographic landscapes on all levels. So when thinking about how to start, I was reminded of the trailer, the wonderful trailer that, that your brothers, the organizers, set, and the brother here I have to congratulate for the wonderful work that he produced. But I asked him, and I commented to him before, I said, you caught me at a very angry moment. And everyone, including Lauren, so serene, so calm, so collected, you know, word for word, absolutely brilliant. And then I came on, and I was like raging. What was wrong with me? The thing is, if you don't know me, you'll think that that is how I am all the time. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that, because that is your window onto me. And that is essentially what the media can do. It gives you an impression of the individual and how he or she behave, how they are, their attitudes, their temperament, their language, their ability or lack thereof to explain themselves. It's quite powerful. It's extremely powerful. And I'm going to come to certain elements, but keep that in mind. And that is what we're talking about when we talk about the power of the media. The power of the media to create impressions that ultimately affect how we deal with each other. Because I'm pretty sure that, you know, I'm hoping that now I'm going to try to break that kind of image that you've created in your minds. But ultimately, if anyone saw that trailer and left, that person wouldn't want to meet me in a dark alleyway anytime soon, because that is the image that they have gone away of me. And that is exactly the issue that we're trying to talk about today when we're talking about the media and Islam. We have this snapshot. We have this window that opens up for a few seconds. Whether it be an image, whether it be a headline, whether it be a tune, whether it be a particular term, it's that snapshot that creates the image in our minds, whether favorable or otherwise, of the other. So let's try to dissect this issue a little bit more, and I'm going to try to concentrate on matters away from what Lauren has to offer, because what she has to say is extremely important later on. Now, as a Muslim, because one of the things that we as Muslims constantly do is use our reference points as Muslims, our ethics, our values, our morals, our upbringings, our cultures and traditions, as well as our main reference points. And when I come to discuss the issue of media in Islam, I read from the Holy Quran a verse which to me encapsulates Islam. It tells me in a few words all that I need to know about Islam. And that verse in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah Almighty, speaks to his messenger, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and he says, he gives him his exact job description, his title, his mission, his task. And he says, وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ إِلَّا رَحْمَةً لِلْعَالَمِينَ. We have sent you not as a messenger, but as a mercy. To whom? To all mankind. In other commentaries, al-alamin not only means mankind, but to all creations, all living things. To me, that tells me exactly all that I need to know about Islam. The nature, the essence of the message, the essence of what we're about, what we're trying to achieve, on what realms we're trying to base our relationship with everyone around us. Islam is not an exclusive message to a particular people, confined to a particular region. And for those who suggest that we need our national state, I say no. That goes against this very message. Because to me, this whole world is the dominion where Islam as a set of values and morals and objectives can thrive, can exist, can interact, can enrich. So ultimately, that is where I want to depart from. Because you see, the question that follows is this. Allah Almighty, in His words, was telling the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who is confined to, at the time, Mecca, being totally persecuted, unable to move, unable to practice or to preach his message openly and publicly, he was telling him that your message is a mercy to all mankind, let alone to all creations. How is this even possible? How is this possible? Essentially, I take from this something which connects to what we're trying to address tonight. How do you reach all of mankind when you're confined to a particular region and a particular geographical space and a particular limitation of means? You don't have the funds, you don't have the resources, you may not even have a valid passport to carry you across borders. How is it possible for this message, for your values, to reach all mankind? I'm just going to leave that hanging, but keep that in mind. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also describes the job description of every single one of us, going on from the Prophet Muhammad and the essential message of Islam onto us as individuals, as Muslims. أُدْعُوا إِلَىٰ سَبِيلِ رَبِّكَ بِالْحِكْمَةِ وَالْمَوْعِظَةِ الْحَسَنَةِ وَجَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنِ. أُدْعُوا, it's a command. Call, invite to the way of your Lord in wisdom and in the most beautiful methods and manners of preaching, and offer beautiful advice. And if you come to disagree, then disagree in ways that are most perfect. Do not raise your voice, do not slander, do not curse, do not swear. Udu'u, call, invite. What are we talking about here? How? How do you do that? What are the methods and means and mechanisms through which you can fulfill that particular command? Establish also the verse that we've just talked about having the message of Islam, the essence of Islam, reach all corners and all people. Again, ask yourself how, what are the mechanisms and what are the dynamics? And finally, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam tells those around him whom complain they don't have sufficient knowledge, you know, they haven't memorized sufficiently of the Quran, for instance, they haven't accompanied him for too long, and therefore, you know, they want to spend, you know, much longer with the Prophet in his company so that then they can reach a particular level of knowledge so that upon that they can go and then speak to other people. The Prophet tells them, بَلِّغُ عَنِّي وَلَوْ آيَةً, deliver on my behalf even if one verse, one word, meaning that no one is free of that burden of inviting, of calling, of delivering the message of Islam. And also, بَلِّغُ, deliver upon me. Again, how? How? If not by the tools that we have today, as well as many, many others. But once again, the media comes into the mix here. Now, we're going to talk about many, many negatives when we're talking about the media and its relationship with Islam, I have no doubt. But I would like us to come to an agreement first and foremost. The previous notion, or a notion that may still exist in the minds of some, I'll tell you this, this is on a personal level. When I was doing my A-levels, and I was coming to the point when I wanted to apply for universities and decide exactly what course my career will take me, my very first choice was media. Now, you may think I'm ancient. I'm not. But this was back in 1986. It seems like a long time ago. To me, it was like a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, I chose media. At the time, at the time. My father said, listen, I'm not going to tell you, you know, what to choose or what not to choose. However, I would say go and consult some of your elders. You know, ask people around. Ask people about what they think about this. I recall asking 7 people whom I really cherished their relationship and knowing them, people of knowledge, people of wisdom. And I went to them individually, and I asked them, I said, listen, I want to study media. And to a man, every single one of them said, don't. Don't. And the reasons were various. Some of them said, oh, the whole media setup is a conspiracy. It's a Zionist conspiracy. It's designed against Islam and Muslims. And you'd have to really, really renege on everything that you are in order to become or to become successful. Others gave me this sermon about how the media is all evil and corrupt and immoral. And in order to, you know, progress within the media, you have to shed all your inhibitions and just basically let go of all your morals and ethics. And essentially, and the best of them said to me, well, you know what? You won't be able to do anything to change the media. So, you know, it's just useless. You'll be on your own. That was the kindest assessment. That those people whom I still treasure and respect, that was their assessment on the media. And ultimately, I didn't go into the media. But now, you see the clamor from all sections, from all people, all communities, to come and be part of the media one way or another. So let's come to an agreement. 1, there is no conspiracy. 2, there is no invisible hand controlling everything and every word that's said, every image that's out there. 3, everything, including the media, and including, this is for another day, politics, depends on how much you put into it. That is how kind it becomes to you and to your views. It's how much you put and invest into it. If you stay outside, others will fill in that vacuum and say what they believe in. And therefore, you'll be just observing, forever shaking your head in total disgust at the lies on the TV screen or coming out from the radio. You will never be part of creating an impression, of creating the story, of suggesting the image. So ultimately, let's start by agreeing that it's down to us, largely whether the media is good or bad. Because you see, even if you're not studying the media or working within the media, you are still a consumer of the media. You are a consumer of the media. How many of us, as consumers of the media, really take that particular position really seriously? How many of us, whom we're all obliged to pay our TV licenses, now your students, we have police officers here, I'm not even going to suggest that people tell me whether they are paying their TV licenses or not, but I'm going to just presume that you all are. Now, how many of us, actually take that particular position, that particular power and influence seriously? So when we see something that we're not happy with, we pick up the phone or write an email or send a text. When we watch or listen to something that we actually like, that we again pick up the phone, write an email or send off a text. How many of us have ever attempted to write a letter to the editor in the Times or the Daily Mail or the Guardian or the Independent, commenting on an article that you read? So you see, we can blame the media or the establishment or this person or that for hours, and part of it will be true. But let's start off by agreeing that most things in life are as good as you put into them. Your studies, your business, your careers, as well as the world around you, whether it be the media that we're talking about today or many other spheres and walks in life. Now, basically, when we're talking about the media, what are we talking about? We may be talking about the means of the media, I mean the channels, the mediums, i.e. TV or radio or the press or magazines. But now, you see, only a few weeks ago, I think, it was in late December, I was reading a magazine, I think it was The Economist, on a flight to the Middle East. And therein was an article that surveyed a few thousand people throughout Europe, and it came to the conclusion that more than 60% of people do not depend on what we call the traditional modes of media, i.e. TV, radio, or the press, but rather they depend on other sources and mediums of the media, including, which we all know now, as the virtual media, the new media, the alternative media. But listen, we know about Facebook, we know about the various social networks and the such, but how many of us have considered other modes of media, such as, I mean, modes of media that are quite available to each and every one of us and don't really depend on how much funds we have or how much political clout we have. For instance, how many of us have considered slogans on your T-shirt to be modes of media? How many of us have considered graffiti to be modes of media? You know, media now has far, you know, transcended the modes that we are all accustomed to and used to. We're now talking about new methods of people communicating with each other, sending messages, sending impressions, opinions, without having to put in either a lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of time, or, you know, being threatened of being closed down or shut down or whatever. So 60% of people actually rely on sources that aren't traditional, and that is a transformation. Because in my time, more than 80% of people relied on the traditional modes of and the 20% that didn't, basically didn't have TVs, or didn't have the means to get a daily newspaper, or to listen to a radio or the such. So basically, those were the modes available. Now, because they've gone far wider, they are available to each and every one of us. بَلِّغُوا عَنِّي وَلَوْ آيَةٌ اُدْعُوا إِلَى سَبِيلِ رَبِّكَ. Now, each and every one of us, really, we don't have any excuse. Now, I'm going to try to run through some what I think are important points. But for me, the most interesting part of tonight is going to be the questions and answers and the discussion, because that is when we will come to really talk about the problems that we are facing today. But let's allow for a few points to be made very clear that where the media is problematic, and this is what philosophers, thinkers, political theorists are now considering. We here in this country and throughout the West and in many, many countries, we regard ourselves as living within a democratic climate. And in fact, this is a climate that we're trying to export to other countries, including the ones where revolutions are now occurring. But the thing is that this democracy relies on a few basic points, a given. Amongst that, of course, when we talk about democracy, we're talking about each and every one of us being equal, having an equal share of the vote, having also an equal share of how our futures are being designed. But all that, you see, that's the pinnacle, that's the final point. But leading up to that final point, there are certain issues that need to be established in order for me to exercise my democratic right. And that is essentially the availability of information freely and equally. So that we all have, I mean, this is quite idealistic, but this is the premise, that we all have the same installation of news and information so that ultimately I can form an opinion based on this news and information, you can form an opinion based on this news and information. However, if I don't have that news and information, or if I have news and information that aren't really correct or authentic or true or complete, then my reservoir of information that then allows me to practice my democratic rights in a proper way is somehow, it's compromised. It's not as perfect as it should be. And therefore, my choice is ultimately going to be affected by that kind of ill reservoir of information that leads me to making the decision that I have. And that's where the media comes in. And that's where the danger of the media comes in. And part of the problem that we have with the media today is some of you who've been following events, the revolution in Egypt, for instance, will have come across a slogan that was used time and time and time again, and that is that the people's problem with the regime was the fact that over the past 30 years, there was this marriage of power and wealth. Power and wealth. So essentially, those who are wealthy have the power, and vice versa. Anyone else, you don't have money, you don't have power. And hence, 98% of the Egyptian people had no money and hence had no power. And to have money and to have wealth, you really needed to compete very, very hard, extremely hard. And more than on most occasions, you wouldn't have a chance of joining the club of the elite. That's what their problem is. Now, the problem that we face with the media is that there is this marriage of not only media and wealth, but media and politics. So there's this triangular relationship that is, well, let's say, it could potentially, and we can discuss whether this is happening or not, it could potentially disenfranchise those that are outside this triangle. Because if ultimately you can only own a media vehicle, such as a newspaper or radio station or a TV station, if you have the money, and if you can only bring this to fruition, if you have some political clout to allow you to bypass certain laws and the such and regulations, it means that you have to really belong to a very elite small club. That is the essential problem that we have with the media today. That actually, we're not as a public really part of the media. We don't truly own information and news, and hence we're not truly, and I'm talking here about everyone, about society as a whole, we're not truly part of formulating the narrative. And when we're talking about the media, by the way, what are we talking about? We're talking about the image, the picture, because I could, if I say something that's, let's say a particular newspaper likes, they'll show me, in one of my best photo shots ever. But if I say something that they dislike, believe me, they'll be showing a very horrid picture of me, a picture that I myself may not even recognize, of me doing this or looking shady or the such or, it's... And by the way, one of the most powerful images of the past 15 years has been of Abu Hamza, in a sort of shadowy image where light comes from one corner, but then there's darkness on the other, and his hook. That is one of the most powerful images of the past 15 years, simply because every time, well, on many, many occasions, there is a story about Muslims, you only need to add that picture, even if the story wasn't about Abu Hamza. And all of a sudden, people wouldn't have to read the article. They would only have to see the image. So the image, as they say, tells more than 1,000 words. Actually, it tells far more than that. And then we have the words, and I'll leave it to Lauren to talk a little bit about that, and how loaded. And I'm a linguist. I know how I could use one word, and I'd be right. But then I could use another word, and I'd be right. But I'd be adding so many layers of meaning. It would be so loaded, so ambiguous, that I would have you thinking and spending that night tossing and turning in your bed. And it's the same word. And it's correct. And then you have things like, which we don't really take seriously, like tunes, music, jingles. I was once fascinated by an experiment that took place at Leeds University many years ago. And it was basically taken from a film, quite a thrilling drama of a scene where someone who is about to go and commit quite a heinous crime, you know, a massacre, was walking determinedly down the main street looking at the target, his eventual target. And the music, the tune that was with this, it was dramatic, it was drums, it was a strong beat, and your heart was pounding with it because you can sense that there was, you know, there was some real danger at the end of this. And there was a determined, really manic look in this person's face to go along with the music. And then they repeated the scene, but with a jingle from the Teletubbies. And all of a sudden, this guy was like shopping on a Sunday afternoon, and it was the very same image, the very same guy with the gun in his holster. But it was a totally different story. A totally different story. So when we're talking about the media, we're talking about many, many, many layers. So think about how much of it are you involved in? How much you influence? How much you are influenced by? And then you can start to understand or to fathom, first of all, how important and significant the media is, and secondly, how much or how little you as an individual, we as a community, as a Muslim community, for instance, or as a student community here at the University of Surrey, or as a society, are playing in really influencing a mode that should help us make that democratic choice ultimately the correct one. That is how dangerous this is. Just to repeat, I'm waiting for the question and answer session. I've just thrown out some ideas. I hope you've enjoyed them. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Bismillahi rahmani rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. I was listening to that with great interest by a great media operator for all that he says there of his work in other areas. This man really knows about the layers of the media and is a great presenter of different stories and narratives himself. I was thinking as well about the point that you made, Anas, about us helping ourselves when we're on television. And I suddenly thought, you know, Abu Hamza did this with his hook. Do you remember? Did he really have to be so creepy? Was he just having a creepy day that day? I really don't know. So we can help ourselves, is what you're saying, in how we as Muslims present ourselves. I've worked hard on the presentation today because I really wanted to get you some examples of the precise wording and the types of stories that are used to perpetuate myths about Islam, or at the very least, to give the official line on the official narrative of what Islam is today, what the majority of people watching Fox News wish to keep hearing, or are forced down their throats. We can talk about that later. Are we giving the people what they want when we in the media paint Islamic people as bad and Islamic nations as bad? Or is this supply and demand? Which way round does it go? So I've worked on two sides of the pond today. I'm going to begin with America, then move to the British press, and then talk a little bit about my own experience in both of those. Islam and Muslim-related issues have taken centre stage now for a decade in a way that other faiths might be green with envy to have the airtime. And what we have to decide is any publicity good publicity? Does all this unwanted attention serve to bolster the perception of Muslims? Or does it present a scenario of helplessness in which one's faith is gawked at like a potentially caged animal about to be released? And has the media created itself and assumed the role of the zoo and the gamekeeper, chaining up the wild animal that is Islam all around us, in amongst our communities, waiting to rise in the Middle East and North Africa again? Or both? The answer to the first question, in my own experience, is this. No, not all publicity is good publicity. Thank you very much. I am Lauren Booth, and I'm a Muslim. I say that in that way as if I'm an alcoholic, because the way my conversion was written about is almost like it was an admission of something really pretty shameful. I'll talk about that in a little while. I've spent quite a long time in Palestine and had the pleasure of living in Gaza for a short while. I've written sympathetically and with interest about groups that are called terrorist groups, which I call freedom fighters. I once recommended that Hezbollah get a page on Facebook. I believe they now have one. I can't say it was my idea. I'll be arrested if I do. I now work for the news channel Press TV, and I make programs mostly on Palestine because it's where my passion is, and because I think, actually, if we can't get it right there as human beings, much less as Muslims, then really we're not going to progress to our next stage. Let's start then with the US and take a look at some of the stories that have been very big there on the subject of Islam in recent months and years. What I've seen during my career is that the attention levied on Islam and Muslims most often takes the form in our print media and on US news channels of blowing a minor story out of all proportion. It increasingly allows the craziest extremes in our society to get unwarranted airtime, whilst, by the way, denying some of the best Muslim spokespeople no time at all to respond to the hideous, heinous Mark Regev on television. I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. The New York City mosque complex. Remember that story about the cultural center? This story was whipped up into a frenzy by, originally, a pair of bigoted anti-Muslim bloggers. One of them, Pamela Geller, an individual who should be summarily dismissed as a loon. And yet, all too often, it's the blogosphere that feeds the media. The media creates a false hysteria, and the public then responds, and the story is carried on. So what happened here? Geller, for example, insists that President Obama's trip to Pakistan in the 80s was originally to go for drugs because he was a drug addict, but that he became indoctrinated into jihad while he was there. Okay, so far so nutty, right? Yet the New York mosque furore started in that same blogosphere with people like Pamela Geller, and within weeks, the disinformation campaign about a cultural center, one that had been approved by the mainstream parties in America and sought to serve a community in difficulties in the land of the free, became known as the Ground Zero Mosque Controversy. What began as a laughable tirade in the blogosphere became a campaign so strong that the equally laughable yet potentially powerful Sarah Palin thought she could jump on the bandwagon. She actually tweeted on the subject. I tell you, I love new media, but if Sarah Palin's using it, we've got to be suspicious. Peace-seeking Muslims, please understand, Ground Zero Mosque is unnecessary. She managed to do that all in uppercase. It's a provocation. It stabs hearts. Please reject it in the interest of healing. Earlier that day, she tweeted, Ground Zero Mosque supporters, doesn't it stab you in the heart as it does ours throughout the heartland? Peaceful Muslims, please repudiate. I think she probably meant repudiate, but never mind. The point here again is the way that words are used. Peaceful Muslims, moderate Muslims, extremist Muslims, radical Muslims, all of these terms, choose what sort of Muslim you are, not by your headscarf or by your fashion designers, no, by where you sit and how the mainstream media brands you for your views. I'm not happy with that, because I'd be a radical extremist Muslim straight away, because I have political views and I wear a hijab. Whoa, I'm way out there. Because if you wear a hijab, as far as the media concerns is, shut up, go and do the cooking, and we'll come and rescue you one day. That's your place. Make no mistake. Don't go and listen to politics if you wear a hijab. You have no right to. Anchors across America promised citizens daily updates on the situation with the Ground Zero mosque that is causing such a controversy. And duly, the American people went hysterical. The fact that this center was the project of an imam sponsored by the State Department as a diplomat was rarely, if ever, deemed a necessary fact to put into these news bulletins. The media creating crises that Muslim leaders must then respond to, the tail wagging the dog. Muslim voices have been silenced or dismissed as anti-free speech when objections are raised to the perpetuation of stereotypes resulting in prejudice. However, we can say that Muslims are often featured in TV news packages. They are often given live airtime. Sometimes these crises they respond to, though, are wholly manufactured in an uncritical media, and the people that they give airtime to, quite frankly, are the barking dogs of the community, the ones where you'd say, if they were in your family, "Ooh, auntie's having one of her funny turns." How do these people suddenly become spokesperson for Islam? Who knows? Let us take the example of the threat against the South Park creators by a group called Revolution Muslim and the International Burn the Quran Day pastor, Terry Jones, and his Dove Outreach Church. Now, the controversy that swirled around South Park was initiated by Revolution Muslim. Who? Good question. I'll tell you who they are. There are 10 of them. 10 members. It was run by one Yusuf Al-Khattab, apparently, born Joseph Cohen, an American Jew, who converted to Islam in 2000 after living in Israel and attending an Orthodox rabbinical school there, then returned to New York. His group has zero credibility in the Muslim community. The 10 people in his group were thrown out of the New York mosque they attended for being crazies. But because they made threats against two much-loved American cartoonists, they became the voice of modern Islam. Thanks very much, guys. As rolling news channels gave over high billing to ludicrous threats. It was about the Prophet Muhammad apparently appearing in the cartoon, by the way, which in the end he didn't. It was supposed to be Santa Claus in the bear costume. Ha, ha, ha. I'm not insulted by it. It's just a cartoon. But these guys threatened the two with death. And so the New York Times billed the story thus: South Park episode altered after Muslim group's warning. Sounds like a big group to me. Not 10 loonies. The result was yet again a perception that Islam not only can't take criticism, but that its followers all accept that a violent reaction is appropriate to the most minuscule, even the imagined insults to their faith. And this perception, interestingly, metacized into a phenomena that pits false paradigms against one another. The media not reporting real life at all, but creating false battles and then getting people involved. Madness. Another crazy tiny group then, in response to that tiny group against South Park, created a day called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day to try and get an outrage about that. And Fox News ran it. This too got attention in the media. I wish there was a crazy land we could send crazy people to sometimes, don't you? So the headlines fade, but the residue of perception of Islam and Muslims as violent, oversensitive radicals remains. Fast forward a few weeks to the debate over Pastor Terry Jones and his call for an international burn the Quran Day on 9/11. This man based his proposed act supposedly on Acts 19:19, in which the early Christians burned the books of witches. He believed he was doing the godly, righteous thing, since Islam was of the devil, and that he was leading people to the doom of hellfire. But notice the difference here. In the coverage of the revolutionary Muslim extremists and the pastor Terry Jones, even though both are fringe groups or individuals, with unbelievably small followings. Only one group, revolutionary Muslim, was allowed to define a whole religion. All of us who are Muslim here, defined by them. I'll give you an example. The distinction was made consistently and repeatedly from the top echelons of the US government through all tiers of mainstream media. Terry Jones, it was clearly pointed out in newspapers and news bulletins, and from politicians, did not speak for Christianity, nor did he speak for America. That was made clear. This man, it does not represent us. Before we go any further into our news bulletin, Terry Jones is not a Christian, in my opinion. What do you think, Hank? But notice the difference. The 10 members of Muslim Revolution were simply devout Muslims. How many people here are devout Muslims? Would you, any of you count yourself as a devout Muslim? I'll put my hand up then. I don't really want to kill Matt Stone and Trey Parker. I quite like South Park. And this from foxnews.com. Just recently on their website. The mere act of criticizing Islam has become an act of politically incorrect hate speech, a media analyst and free speech advocate says, citing several incidents in recent weeks where people have been lambasted publicly for their remarks. We're living in a here and now where no one's allowed to say that anything bad happens about Islam, it seems, says Dan Gaynor, Vice President of Business and Culture at the Media Research Center. The most recent transgressor, he says, is Marty Peretz, the editor-in-chief of the News Republic and a former Harvard professor, who's come under attack for a blog post in which he wrote, "Muslim life is cheap, most notably to Muslims." He even questioned whether Muslims deserved protection from the First Amendment. He went on to say, "We're fighting a war against radical Islam," he told foxnews.com. "For radical Islam, life is cheap, both for their lives and our lives." Another watchword, radical. In the UK, we always feel slightly superior to America in our news coverage. I'm not sure that we should. Let's have a few of our recent tabloid news headlines just to make that point. Ever heard the one about Muslim medics spreading disease across Leicester by refusing to roll up their sleeves in the wash basin? That appeared in a national newspaper. Now, I'm new to Islam, but I'll tell you what. My old wardrobe has had to be changed. A lot of it's too low cut, but mostly because I can't get the sleeves up. Because we all know, how many times a day do we have to wash up to here? My arms are never dry. They actually got chapped the first month. But here we are. A basic point in journalism is to do your research. They're saying Muslims don't wash in Leicester and killing people. Right. How about the Muslim Council employees who banned Christmas in Lambeth, renaming Christmas lights to the generic sounding winter lights? Another false story in the tabloid press. Both of these stories were reported by mainstream British newspapers in the last 4 years, and both are, of course, untrue. The Channel 4 investigation, Muslims Under Siege, in 2008, took these claims apart. Now, look, no one expects the tabloid press to immediately adopt a nuanced take on all things holy. But was the news editor asleep at the helm when these appeared in the newspapers? Or is it so accepted that Muslims are going to behave in a way that is retrograde for society that they just don't bother fact-checking these stories like they do every other page in their newspaper? That's something I want you to ask yourselves, and then you can ask us. And there's more. Christmas is evil. Muslim group launches poster campaign against festive period. These people don't represent anyone in this room, I'm guessing. And the latest WikiLeaks revelation, 1 in 3 British Muslim students back killing for Islam. 40% want Sharia law. And finally, just recently, the Faith Matters report on conversion to Islam was headlined in The Independent last month, much to the agency's fury, the Islamification of Britain. When did that stuff move from EDL leaflets onto the pages of The Independent? I would say in the last 48 months. Since 2000, UK findings have showed that most media reports portray Muslims as one, dangerous, willing to cut off hands for petty crimes, sexually violent to women and children, and of course, terrorists. Two, Muslims are living in the Middle Ages, a phrase regularly applied to the perceived Muslim way of life, the British model, of course, being modern and up to date. Three, Islam has values incompatible with British life. We can discuss that later if you like. But worse still for me personally has been the way that those I have worked with for 20 years on the left have, in my opinion, become outright Islamophobes. They express disgusting opinions in the pages of newspapers that I once respected. These were my friends, and I don't understand where they've gone to, I promise you. Now, Polly Toynbee was never a friend, but I knew her and respected her writing, and yet she has written, "I'm an Islamophobe and proud of it." Think about that statement for a moment, please, in the Guardian newspaper. The Independent's Bruce Anderson, more right-wing. There are widespread fears that Muslim immigrants, reinforced by political pressure and ultimately by terrorism, will succeed where Islamic armies failed and change irrevocably the character of European civilization, to which some of us might say good. It worked several hundred years ago in Spain. Author Martin Amis in The Times has written, "There is a definite urge, don't you have it? The Muslim community will have to suffer until it gets its house in order." This is our mainstream press today. Now, my conversion to Islam was interesting. People ask me how did I feel about what was written about me. I usually try not to read it, but some of it filters through. People go, "You've got to read this, you won't believe it." It's like, I don't want to. No, really, you've got to. It's so horrible. You've got to. And then you read it and you go, "Oh, it's really horrible." So I was either given a monstering by commentators in print journalism or patronised. "Oh, that's nice. You had a little breakdown." "Oh, bless you. I want to be modest." Because, you see, for the mainstream media, their narrative has been that Islam is so corrupt, it's so frightening, it so oppresses women, that no one who hadn't had some kind of breakdown, no one who was truly educated, no one with critical thinking could naturally progress to, say, Shahada, much less wear the veil. For some reason, men in their middle age get to drive Ferraris and have young girlfriends. Middle-aged women turn to Islam. I don't know how that works, but that's what they seem to be saying. I was waiting when I went on to an evening show with Andrew Neil and, what's his name, the Tory MP, Portillo. Anybody know that? The evening one on BBC. I'd only come out as a Muslim 2 weeks earlier, and I was really quite tense about the whole thing. And I thought, okay, just let Andrew Neil go on about women's rights. Because I knew that would be his thing. So, agree with stoning women, do you? Cutting off their clitorises, giving them bad husbands and beating them with sticks? So I had a really corker of a line that I was ready to use. I was going to say, "Andrew Neil, I don't think Muslim women want you to care about them, considering how many favours you've bought off women in the past." And he was so nice, I never got to use it. I was really gutted about that. Again, he took the patronising line, the BBC being careful, afraid of Muslim vengeance, no doubt. When Julia Roberts converted to Hinduism, I don't recall seeing a single comment piece that was unpleasant about her choice. Richard Gere and Buddhism, excellent, good man, what a kind and deep soul he must have. These are acceptable religions to convert to in our media. However, try converting to Islam in the public eye. See how that feels for size. Julie Birchall wrote, what sort of woman, I was going to do her voice then, but that's petty. I'm Muslim, I'm not going to do that. Bismillah. What sort of woman freely converts to a religion which supports the oppression, torment, and murder of thousands of Christians, homosexuals, and spirited women worldwide every year? The sort of woman who writes love letters to a serial killer. Now, there's so much to take apart in that one phrase. I suppose the thing that really got to me was that it was in The Independent again, that these things were just taken as read, that these offensive articles about Islam, not about me, but about Islam, were just allowed to freely pass Simon Kellner, another man I've always had a great deal of respect for in the past. After that, major groups, Muslim groups around the country, wrote a letter to Simon Kellner, by the way, demanding that he retract that phrase, thousands of Christians, homosexuals, and spirited women killed by Muslims every year worldwide, retract it. Do you know what he did? Not only did he not print the letter, he didn't even respond to it from his personal office. Think about that. A major editor taking a letter from groups around the country, not even taking the time to respond. I think that says everything about the print media in our country, at the moment. In 2007, I went to Lebanon and I met some women there of Hezbollah. My expectations of what the women of Hezbollah are like were pretty much based on what I'd read in the media and those imaginings that it led to. So I expected women in the burqa who were really quiet and shy. The women that met me at Beirut Airport were sort of like EastEnders meets Islam. Yeah? You want to go somewhere? They were like this. I'm telling you, they were amazing. They were just like, no boy's going to tell me what to do, innit? Except with an Arabic accent. I couldn't believe it. They had the right to marry when they wanted. They were top of their class in engineering, in journalism, media. And they got men to, men stood back and respected them because they were choosing to be modest. You know what Lebanon's like. It's a pluralist society. You don't have to wear the hijab. There are no rules. Muslims practicing as they wish. I was amazed. But still, I thought, I'm going to watch how they're treated by the men of Hezbollah. Ha! Ha ha ha! You're not going to trick me, you Muslim trickers. So we went and we met a commander of Hezbollah, and I did an interview with him and the three young ladies, two of them called Zainab, were in the room, and I was watching the interaction with my feminist antennae up. And at one point, the sheikh was talking, and one of the young ladies went, whoop, in mid-flow. And I thought, here we go. He's going to get a big whip out and give him a good lashing. I've seen the movie. I've watched the clips on the Telegraph website. And do you know what that sheikh did? It was utterly shocking. Do you know what he did? I'll tell you what he did. He did this. Go ahead, sister. What was that all about? Now, I realized at the end of that trip that I had something that I call hijab envy. Because I came back to the UK and I saw a lot of students, young women students, really competing, I think I'd see it, for male attention using their bodies and not getting the respect for their work that they're probably due because of the way they were dressing. And I thought, wow, those women had more freedom in a way, in a very big way, than a lot of these student females who think they're free. And I wanted to write about this. I was pretty well known at the time, 2007. I'd been writing for 10 years for every major newspaper. I tried for 3 years to get that article in. Every magazine, every Sunday magazine, every Sunday newspaper, every daily, no one would take it because it went against the narrative that the hijab is bad, Islam is bad for women, Hezbollah bad, hijab bad. You can't like it. But eventually I did manage to sneak it in a national paper. I got it into the Mail on Sunday. I wrote about it and got it in late one Friday night. They had to go in by the Saturday. Actually, Peter Wright's is the best editor at the moment, and he liked the idea, but it took 4 years. Now, this week, to wrap up, more than 20 Palestinians have been killed by Israel since last Wednesday, including a six-month-old baby. Has anybody heard about this in the mainstream media? No, you won't have done. It's an irrelevance. Increasingly, the mainstream media is making itself a joke. And I'm happy about that. I'd rather be out of a job writing a free blog than working for the BBC. Because there's propaganda and there's warmongering, and we've long ago crossed the line in a lot of our news agencies. The other way that Muslim women in Europe and North America exist, of course, in the media, is as victims or as exotic and naughty beneath their clothes. Think Sex and the City too, if you have to. The real aim of the Danish and Norwegian right-wing newspapers to publish the cartoons of the Prophet wasn't to do with free speech. It was to provoke hostile reactions from small extreme groups and create a news agenda. It's important to look at the strategic goals of such editors and publishers when we read the newspapers we choose to read. I just want to talk about recent events in the Middle East, some examples of headlines before I go. The great uprisings in North Africa and across that region. Ignoring the cry for freedom plays into the hands of the Brotherhood, said the Times. They tell the West, and the Brotherhood will turn Egypt into another Islamic fundamentalist state like Iran. Revolutionary fervor sweeps the streets in other Arab states, the Times. Liberties will be affected if Islamic parties gain traction. Protesters hold Cairo as Hague warns of extremists, the Sunday Times. Who should be the president of Egypt? It's a sovereign nation. It continues, far preferable, of course, to Egypt falling into the hands of extremism, continues the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic faction involved in the uprising. Still, there is one good piece of good news I want to leave you with. There is a story that could combine all these elements in one of the greatest media moments of all time, if it's true, and I hope it is. Paris Hilton says the blogosphere is a Muslim. Anybody read that? Apparently, she's changing her name to Tahira. She's opening a mosque in Beverly Hills. And she's given up being, I quote, a celebrity skank. Not my words, a direct quote from this supposed trueness. Now, if the blogosphere and the right wing can get stories about New York Ground Zero Mosque out, perhaps they can make this the mainstream story of the decade. But then, of course, to make it a really good story, we'd need Paris Hilton to be caught looking at websites on how to make bombs, wouldn't we? Thank you very much.